Mr. Bailey, Reel 3. So, did you get any impression of Spencer Chapman as a man?
Well, the only time that I actually spoke to him was after the war was over. And perhaps I could come to that in a minute. Because after the Japanese surrendered, we came down into a small village called Surrender, strangely enough, S-U-R-R-E-N-D-A-H, which was quite near us, a town called Kajang, which was a hotbed of communist intrigue, this particular town of Kajang. And I went into Kuala Lumpur at one stage to tell Spencer Chapman of the trouble brewing among the Chinese communists, but he wouldn't listen. He thought I was exaggerating.
What kind of trouble were you referring
well,
to?
Well, it was quite obvious that they were contemplating taking the country over. And, of course, they had substantial political control in the areas where they operated.
How had you discovered all this, though?
Well, again, perhaps I can just come to that in a moment. I think the interesting part is that when we came down into this village of Surrender, about a fortnight after the war was over, we were attacked by the Japanese, who alleged that they'd had reported to them that there were terrorists in the village and they'd come to clear them out. But I wondered whether they knew that we were there as well. As it happened, John Davis was down the road in a hospital with about a dozen Gurkhas, and he came up with a Union Jack and the Gurkhas, and the attack was called off. But in fact, they shot the guard outside the police station. We were stationed in the police station there, and they shot the guard. But anyway, that all fell away. And
this was 2 weeks after VJ.
That's right. The other point I was making was that after surrender, I went into Kajang, where I stayed in a bungalow there, and one evening we went into a hut. When I say we, I'm talking about another radio operator and myself, because the car that we were using had broken down, and we knew that there was a mechanic among the guerrillas. And we went in this hut to try and find him, and they were obviously having a political meeting in there. And we were stopped by armed guards with the rifles pointing at us. And whether they thought we were spying on them or not, I don't know, but I think they were quite ready to shoot us. And we explained that we were just looking for the mechanic, and they said he wasn't there, so we left pretty smartly. And I went into Kuala Lumpur and explained this to Spencer Chapman, but he thought that I was exaggerating. And the pity of it is that we had a victory parade in Kuala Lumpur where we had all the local resistance forces on the race course, surrounded by British forces. We could easily have disarmed them all, and that would have been the end of it, but we didn't. They marched back into the jungle with their arms that we'd supplied, and that was when the trouble started.
What did Spencer Chapman say in reply to what you said?
No, I think he just said he thought I was exaggerating. That he was sure that you know, everything was going to be all right, because he was a great supporter of the Chinese, and I think he had some justification, because they'd looked after him when he was on his own, before there was any Force 136 in the region. He went in there on his own, and they looked after him.
So it was the secretiveness of this group that made you suspicious?
Yes. And it was always apparent, even before then, that if ever any of them appeared to be friendly towards the British officers who help, somehow they disappeared. They went on other duties elsewhere. I don't think they were mistreated. I don't think they were killed or anything like that. I think they were just drafted away elsewhere. You never saw them anymore.
How do you think this Japanese attack on you had come about when the surrender had occurred?
Well, they could only have heard within the last 14 days that we were in this village, because we didn't come down there until after the Japanese were supposed to have surrendered. So they must have got some information from a local source. And they came out from Kuala Lumpur to attack. But the other strange part about this is that they had the garrison commander in Kuala Lumpur with the attack force, which wasn't very large. So I think he realized there was more to it than that. I think he knew we were there. What his objective was, I don't know.
Did they do any damage?
No. What they wanted was for us to go back into Kuala Lumpur with them, but to leave them to deal with the guerrillas. And I think that if we'd done that, they would have shot them. But we said, no, we wouldn't do that. If we were going into Kuala Lumpur, we would all go. And they produced the transport, and we all went into Kuala Lumpur and took control of the town.
What was the situation in Kuala Lumpur when you got there?
It wasn't too bad. Japanese had obviously ran the civil government there, and it wasn't too bad. They didn't seem to be starving, but they were all pleased to see us. I think the Chinese and Indian population had a difficult time, but the Malays, I think, probably did rather better.
What did you see of the Japanese forces in Kuala Lumpur?
In what way?
What kind of impression did they make on you?
Very well disciplined, very fit. I think we'd have had a difficult time with an invasion. Yes, there was no... the morale, in fact, was quite high, considering the fact that they'd surrendered.
Earlier, I'd asked you about the composition of your team Surrey going into Malaya, and I interrupted you with you only having said there was Colonel John Davis in it.
Yeah, he wasn't in my team. He was... what I was trying to say to you was this was an entirely different sort of operation than either France or Burma. This was quite a large unit that we had operating in the jungle in Malaya, which was generally controlled by Chinese. We were only there as a group, and there were a number of officers and non-commissioned officers there, radio operators, who were there really for liaison intelligence gathering and communication with Ceylon. And it happened that John Davis was there as one of the liaison officers. He was nothing to do with my group. We didn't go in as a team, in other words. I went in as a operator that was required.
You were just dropped as an individual?
Yes. Although I dropped with five other people, I went as an operator, as a wireless operator.
How did the Chinese guerrillas in Malaya compare with the people you've been operating with in Burma?
Oh, different proposition altogether. They operated as an army unit. They had uniforms and a command order which was non-existent in Burma, apart from the Burmese National Army detachment that we got, but that wasn't much of a unit as far as army discipline was concerned. But no, they were well regimented and well controlled.
How did you come out of Malaya? What else happened to you there?
Yes, after we came out of the jungle and finished up in Kuala Lumpur, we were there for a few weeks. And I then came down to Singapore with a group of others, and we went on an old tramp steamer with an Indian battalion over to Madras. And from Madras I went back to Ceylon, where the unit disbanded, Force 136 disbanded. There was some suggestion that we mounted another operation in Sumatra, and I was to be commissioned in the field to go on this operation, but it fell through.
We've been talking about your work for SOE during the war. Were you familiar with those initials or with the phrase Special Operations Executive during the war, or was it just some initials that you learned about after the war?
Gosh, funny, I've never been asked that question. I've no idea. I think we were familiar with it during the war because I recall the Americans were OSS, and I'm sure that we were aware that ours came under the SOE banner, as the Americans came under OSS. Yes, I think I was aware of it during the war.